From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tite. Today on the show, the owner of the Red Sox in Milwaukee this week talks about Bud Selig's retirement and the sport's troubles with steroids. Later, writer and producer Paul Attanasio reflects on some advice he got as a young filmmaker.
And Joe's advice to me was, don't do it. And I disagreed with him. I came out here, and I'm not sure my advice would be any different. But you can't tell people what to do.
How the Coast Guard helped in the making of a movie in Milwaukee this year. And Hannah Kent recalls traveling to Iceland and learning about a woman who she would feel compelled to write about.
I was always really struck quite early on at the way in which they would talk about this woman, Agnes, almost as though she were a kind of Nordic Lady Macbeth, you know, this inherently wicked woman.
Lake Effect is next, after the news. It's Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tite. Great to have you listening today. Major League Baseball's playoffs are underway, and so is the search for the next commissioner of baseball. Current commissioner and former Milwaukee Brewers owner Bud Selig made it official last week when he announced that next season will be his last at the helm of the major leagues. He'll leave the sport at a time when attendance is strong, but also as the game is troubled by the use of performance-enhancing drugs. Brewers star Ryan Braun served out a suspension this season for ties to a shady clinic in Florida. One of the sport's financial giants is the Boston Red Sox, who will open the playoffs tonight against the Tampa Bay Rays. The Sox surprised many by finishing tied for the best record in baseball. Tom Werner is part of the group that bought the Red Sox in 2002. The former television executive also owns the Liverpool Football Club in the English Premier League. He was in Milwaukee this week to speak at a business leaders forum at Marquette University and sat down with us before the speech. Welcome to Lake Effect.
It's my pleasure to be here.
Well, and so let's start with the Red Sox for a moment. This is a team that not only finished last in the AL East last year, but seemed to be mired in kind of chaos. This year, they finished with 97 wins. They ran away with the division and seemed to be a model of team chemistry. When you look at that evolution, how do you quantify what makes a difference so profoundly?
Well, these things don't happen just accidentally. You make a lot of decisions. We made some decisions last year that didn't pan out, but you learn from your mistakes as well as your successes. I think we've started on the road to a better team this year by making that gigantic trade with the Dodgers last August. Most important thing, we traded away all stars, but the most important thing is it gave us enormous payroll flexibility going forward. And we brought in a bunch of gritty players in the offseason that all loved baseball, loved to talk about baseball. There was a great new spirit in the clubhouse. Obviously, we asked John Farrell to be our manager, who we had a lot of confidence in. He was our pitching coach a couple of years ago. And I think that we felt in camp that we were going to surprise a lot of people. I don't think that I would have been able to predict as many victories as we had, but we thought that we were far better than the prognosticators thought.
You are in Milwaukee and at Marquette this week to talk about the business of sports. How do you reconcile the idea that big business is not necessarily something to be guided by emotion with the reality of owning a sports franchise, which is entirely about the emotions of your customers, if you will?
First of all, these are all big businesses. You know, you are making decisions that maybe I'm changing your question a lot, but some people say to me, so you have fun owning a baseball team. He says, well, it's not fun, it's challenging. But I think that one of the themes in my speech is that, you know, you are in a very competitive entertainment world where you are fighting for people's dollar, for their attention, for their heart. And the one thing that I think is true is you've got to have an excellent product. If you have an excellent product, then a lot of the problems take care of themselves. And if you don't have an excellent product, I feel in some ways you're on a leaky rowboat and it's very hard to plug the leak. We're very fortunate in Boston to have a loyal fan base, but even that loyal fan base, one of the concerns that people had after we won the World Series in 2004 is you've got such a history of coming close and not winning the World Series. How is your fan base going to adapt to the fact that you're winning? And we now have 10-year-old children in Boston who've grown up knowing that the Red Sox consistently win 90 games every year. It's a very different mindset than their parents and their grandparents.
I laugh knowing that my daughter was born the year that the Red Sox won their first World Series in 86 years and, yeah, has a completely different attitude towards the team her dad roots for. Sports, though, are unusual in the context of business, though, right? I mean, you mentioned the idea that you have to deliver, if you own a candy bar company, you have to deliver an excellent product. People might be unhappy with how their candy bar turned out, but they wouldn't necessarily presume to believe they could run the business better than the candy company. At the same time, if the Red Sox lose or the Brewers or the Packers lose, for that matter, everyone in the fan base thinks they could do a better job than the leadership of the team.
Well, that's probably a good thing, though, because it means that your fans are interested in your product. They're reading about it. They're watching it on television. I don't know whether I would go as far as George Steinbrenner, who said any publicity is good publicity. But to the degree that people are talking about your product every day, that they're saying, well, I don't know why the manager didn't pull out that pitcher earlier or what was the strategy there, that's a good thing because it means you're in the conversation.
What are you looking for in a new baseball commissioner?
I think, first of all, present Commissioner Bud Selig has led the sport brilliantly, and his accomplishments are many, from increasing the popularity of the sport to increasing the number of teams in postseason to peace with the players to growing awareness of the sport, not just in America but around the world. His accomplishments are many. It's going to be tough to replace him, and it's early days, obviously, but he has really been a consensus builder, and I think that one of the things that we'd be looking for in the next commissioner is somebody who can bring the owners together, because there are a lot of different owners with a lot of different agendas, and Bud's done a very good job leading the way and keeping peace.
We are talking in a city that was without its star baseball player for much of the season, thanks to his involvement with performance-enhancing drugs. How far do you think baseball still needs to go to repair the collateral damage, and where do you see the performance-enhancing drug issue on the agenda of the next commissioner?
I think that baseball has done a really good job in trying to rid itself of the steroid problem. I think that as compared to the other professional sports, I think its drug testing program is widely recognized as being the most rigorous. That doesn't mean that there aren't always going to be people who are going to try to evade the system. And so it's up to the players' union and the owners and the fans to insist on trying to stay ahead of anybody who might be trying to find something that they can put in their system that might escape detection. So, I mean, I think it's a very important problem because it has tainted the sport, and I think that, it's a compliment to Bud Selig that he has been as focused on dealing with this problem, but to deny that it's all gone, I mean, I don't think it's all gone, because I think that the ability to cheat in any sport is there, so we just have to continue to be vigilant.
When you hear rumors swirling that another group of players is going to get swept up in something like this, do you have fears that the next time it might be someone with the Red Sox?
I think that the vast majority of players are going to self-police this issue and do what they can, because, you know, you talk to players in our clubhouse, and they were very, very upset about Alex Rodriguez. They felt that this was something that was not just harming the Yankees, that it was harming the sport. So I think that I'm going to look to the players to self-police this in many ways.
Has your experience chairing the Liverpool Football Club changed how you do business as a baseball owner?
There's a lot of similarities. Again, you were asking about the customer or the fan. One of the things that is similar between the Red Sox and Liverpool is they have both very loyal, very deep fan bases. Part of what makes soccer interesting is it's such a global sport. So the passion for Liverpool is felt not just in Liverpool or in the UK, but it's in Jakarta and Hong Kong and Tokyo and all around the world. And so that's something that's very interesting. And I think that I've learned a lot being involved with Liverpool that I hope makes me a better executive at the Red Sox.
How important do you see the United States in the future to European soccer, global soccer. You know, there's been a lot of money thrown into securing the television rights to the English Premier League in this country, for example.
Well, all you have to do is look at the spending power of the average American consumer. There may not be as many Americans watching soccer as in China, but the spending power of the American consumer is such that you have to try to get him to be more involved. And NBC, as you know, got the rights from Fox this last year, and all the Premier League games are on NBC channels. And I think it's very important to continue to grow the sport in America. And the product is quite good. So I don't know if you yourself watch the soccer, Mitch, but it's the best league in the world. It's very entertaining, and these players, I mean, I know because I was talking to Teddy, two of Teddy's children are playing soccer, and Teddy's a soccer coach, and to see what these men can do, it's extraordinary the way that they can handle the ball, and it's fun to watch.
You use the metaphor of the leaky rowboat and the challenges in turning around a product that is suffering financially. The financial realities of English soccer are interesting. I mean, I'm interested, for example, in the significance of these mega tournaments like the Champions League, which I know Liverpool has missed getting into for the past few years. How important are those opportunities? I mean, how long can a team miss out without losing their ability to make it? Does it become a self-fulfilling prophecy after a while?
It's very important for Liverpool to make it. For some of your listeners who don't know, is that the top four teams in the Premier League play in the Champions League the following year, and the top two teams in Spain and the top teams in Italy and Germany. And it is the equivalent of postseason. And because soccer is a global sport, there's a lot of revenue that the team can make if they make it to that league and or make it to that championship. And it's very important for our economics because we have a very high-priced payroll. And to keep the best players, it's not only important for us to make it to Champions League, but the players who are the best players in the world want to play in that league. And it's for those people who don't understand it, you are playing in more than one league at a time when you're playing soccer. And it can be very confusing.
Well, and is there something to be said for the idea of relegation? Should we be looking at that in Major League Baseball?
I think relegation is a fantastic idea. I think it is extremely entertaining. It's not quite the same structure, but imagine if the worst team in the major leagues this year dropped down to AAA and the best team in AAA moved up to the majors. And what is true is that in the last week of the Premier League, the excitement is as much on who's dropping down as who's winning the league, because there's a lot of fans who are going to be devastated if your team is relegated.
It would be something to see the Yankees in AAA, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it would be very interesting. But who's the worst team this? What was the worst team this year? Was it Houston?
Houston, yeah.
So imagine the pressure, and I think that might be. This is pie in the sky. I'm not going to say that that's the way it should work in baseball, but it would force them to be extremely competitive because the economic risk of dropping down would be quite severe.
Well, it would also change the whole significance of the trade deadline. You wouldn't necessarily see teams casting off their players and just playing out the string.
I don't want it to be misquoted as saying Werner wants Houston relegated. I'm just saying that there are a lot of interesting things about soccer, and one of them is this concept of relegation.
Well, and I'm also interested, you came to sports from television, and you're raising the idea of relegation, and we won't misquote you, but I wonder how much imagination you're able to apply to sports ownership versus what you were able to do in television.
I hope a lot. For one thing, you have to continually be on top of your game. The Red Sox are working 24/7 to keep their customers, and whether it's coming up with a new loyalty program for customers, we had an organic concept that grew this year, which was very interesting. We had many of our players started to grow beards, so first we said, well, how can we actually involve the fans? And we came up with the slogan, Blood, Sweat, and Beards, which was a fun slogan. And then one night in the middle of the week, we knew that we had 3,000 or 4,000 tickets left to sell. And we said that anybody who came to the park with a beard, or even a beard that you could, you know, draw on your own face, would get in for a dollar. That created a certain amount of buzz. That created a certain amount of fun. The broadcast was filled with people who came to the game with the craziest beards you've ever seen. And so that was just a way of taking advantage of something that grew organically. And I think that every day we're thinking about how to keep the fans, how to make the team more accessible. That's one of the things that I'm going to be talking about, is it's important for baseball to encourage our players to be more accessible in order to strengthen the connection.
I wonder if the Red Sox really rough year last year didn't make some of this possible, the idea that you could go out and reconnect with your fans.
Well, one of our players said when they came to spring training, it wasn't that they had something to prove. We didn't enter the season with something to prove. We just entered the season that none of us wanted to go through that again.
Well, and so let me join the idea of television with the idea of sports for a minute. Who was the harder negotiator, Scott Boras or Roseanne?
Well, you know, I am happy that I'm not seeing either of them today.
Well, Tom Werner, thank you so much. I really appreciate your time.
Thanks, Mitch.
Tom Werner is chairman and an owner of the Boston Red Sox and the Liverpool Football Club in the English Premier League. He was in Milwaukee this week to speak at Marquette University's annual Business Leaders Forum. Incidentally, Werner's son, Teddy, is director of business operations for the Milwaukee Brewers. Keep listening. There is more of Lake Effect in just a moment on WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Tyke. Tomorrow evening, the Milwaukee Film Festival will host an evening with Paul Attanasio. In this city, Attanasio may be best known for being the brother of Milwaukee Brewers owner Mark Attanasio, but his broader fame is as a screenwriter and producer. Attanasio wrote more than 100 episodes of the acclaimed TV show Homicide: Life on the Street, as well as the movies Donnie Brasco and Quiz Show, among others. More recently, he was executive producer on the Fox series House. Lake Effect's Dan Harmon reached Attanasio by phone from California, and Attanasio weighed in on the current state of the film industry.
I think it's an incredibly exciting time to be starting out in film and television. I think what you see happening is, because of technology, you have much greater access for creative people to distribution. And so, and you have many more finance entities at the kind of lower levels of capital. So if you are a young person and you want to make a movie today, you can get a camera. You can rent a camera for not very much money. You can buy a Red for more money than that. But, you know, we shot an episode of House on, you know, for broadcast with a Canon camera, you know, an SLR camera. And the barriers to entry are so low now. And then you can just put it up on the web and see if people find it. So I think that that aspect of it is revolutionizing the opportunities for creative people starting out. And I think you're going to see much more diversity of work, much more diversity of programming. You know, at the kind of the higher level, you see a very similar thing with in the television space because of Netflix, people having a lot more opportunity to watch television, to do so-called binge viewing, where they watch 6 or 8 hours of television on a rainy weekend. And it's both creating much more opportunity, because you have many buyers now in that cable slash pay TV space, and it's creating a different kind of storytelling where because the audience is, in essence, reading the programming like a novel, it allows for more novelistic storytelling, more depth of character, more detours, more ragged edges. And so I think in that space is incredibly exciting. As I said, and then the traditional independent movie space, which, you know, the budgets have come, you know, keep coming down, but the number of people who are willing to sign a check keeps going up.
That's pretty evident if you just go to a film festival. It's almost an explosion of independent filmmakers and people filming things that they would not have been able to 10 years ago just because of the availability of equipment. Do you think that's had more of a, maybe we call it a democratic effect on film? Or do you think that, I don't know, if one is being mean-spirited, they might say, well, there's a lot of stuff that's just not worth watching. Or maybe that's the way it should be, that, you know, you have to pick and choose.
You know, I think there's always been a lot of stuff that's not worth watching.
Okay.
And, you know, if you go back to, you know, the gold, I have a fondness for the golden age of the studio system, and then when you go back and look at the titles, you know, most of them are crappy. You know, in the so-called golden age of television, or some people say we're in a second golden age of television, there's still a lot of separating the wheat from the chaff. So I don't think there's anything. I think it's great and exciting that more people can get in and make films, and they don't have to wait for somebody to tell them that what they wrote or what they have to say is worth saying.
Let me just put it a different way, which is, how much of this kind of newfound ability to be creative and in production, how much of that, and why doesn't it, if one doesn't agree, why doesn't it trickle up to production houses or bigger budget? It doesn't seem like that's the case. It seems like Hollywood and production are sort of in the same mode, or we're still stuck on reality shows. So there's all this creativity out there, but it's at a level below what most of us see on television.
Starters, they're two different cultures. So, you know, when I started, it was an idea that you know, it was very similar to the way the book list used to work, where they would publish younger authors and take a flyer, bring them along. You know, when I started, there was a sense that you would make these movies within the system that were smaller, but that you would kind of raise up a generation within the system. And now the farm team, as it were, is first of all worldwide, but second, they're not coming up within the Hollywood system. So there is a complete culture shock. Now, sometimes it does work very well. In terms of the, you know, trickling up, I would disagree with you to the extent that, for example, Paul Greengrass, who has come one of the top five directors of Hollywood, when he came to do the second Bourne movie, he really had done only little small political movies in Great Britain, and that were great and very distinguished. And he came out of that, came into a studio setting, made a genre movie that was fantastic, made a sequel to it that was just as fantastic, and now he's part of the Hollywood firmament.
Okay.
So it does trickle up to some degree. But you know, there's a culture shock.
Okay.
And, you know, we don't have a farm team. So the farm team is, the farm teams are out there doing their own thing. And then you have to kind of bring them into, making Hollywood films.
I want to get your opinion because you're in a unique position to answer it, which one hears rumors, I guess, about and just kind of murmurings around production people that there's sort of a talent drain in Hollywood, or people are either getting fed up with not being able to be creative, or maybe the financial burdens are just becoming so great that there's sort of a dispersal both around the U.S. and around the world of talent from Southern California and looking to do their own thing. Do you think it's true? And B, will it have a good effect on production?
The only talent drain I see is I think there's a real talent drain or brain drain out of traditional broadcast TV. Traditional broadcast TV has become too miserable, too limiting for many people, many writers who would prefer to make less money and go work in cable TV where the strictures are very different. There's not the kind of volatility of shows being canceled. There's not the same ratings pressure. And there's not the content restriction. And not that the network presidents on the cable side don't also get their 2 cents in, but it really is considerably less intrusive than in broadcast TV. And on the other side of it, the goodies and the payoff and the rewards of broadcast TV have shrunk. There's still more than you can make in cable, but it's not the same the same disparities used to be. So I see a brain drain there. I don't see really a brain drain out of Hollywood films. I think Hollywood films, for many people, is still the major leagues, and there is still a curiosity or a desire for a director who's made a success in smaller movies to see if he can work on a bigger scale. And, you know, going back in time, you know, the Coen brothers are one of the few examples of people who really substantially opted out of the Hollywood system. And despite their great early success and despite their great later success, you know, they made True Grit at Paramount. They've really largely stayed out and done their own thing, sought their own financing. For the most part, people take a different arc, and they at least come and try it, even if they then leave.
I just want to ask you one more thing, and I'm curious, since you're going to be here tomorrow night at the Milwaukee Film Festival, where there's all kinds of aspiring filmmakers, well, they're not really aspiring because they've made films, what the Paul Attanasio of now would say, you know, what would you say to yourself if you could meet the Paul Attanasio of 20 years ago or at the time you were getting started? Do you have any advice?
Well, you know, when I started with Joe Mankiewicz, the great writer, director of All About Eve and so many other great films. And Joe's advice to me was, don't do it. And I disagreed with him. I came out here, and I'm not sure my advice would be any different, but you can't tell people what to do.
Right. Well, Paul Attanasio, thank you for coming on Lake Effect. Let me give you a pre-welcome to Milwaukee, and congratulations on your successful career.
Thank you very much. I can't wait to get to Milwaukee. I always have a great time there.
Writer and producer Paul Attanasio speaking with Lake Effect's Dan Harmon. Attanasio's credits include TV shows such as House and Homicide, Life on the Street, and movies such as Quiz Show. He'll be featured in An Evening with Paul Attanasio tomorrow at the Milwaukee Film Festival. There's a link to more information from wuwm.com/lakeeffect. Another break, and then we'll learn how the U.S. Coast Guard works to ensure the service is portrayed accurately in movies and TV shows. This is Lake Effect from WUWM. More of Lake Effect now. I'm Mitch Teich. Before the break, we heard from filmmaker Paul Attanasio, one of the people being honored with a tribute at the Milwaukee Film Festival Saturday evening. Sunday, the Milwaukee Film Festival features a panel discussion offering people a sneak peek at several movies in progress, all being made by Wisconsin filmmakers. One of them is The Surface, a film we've heard about in the past on this show. We've spoken with producer Jeff Gendelman, director Gil Cates Jr., and star Sean Astin. Much of the movie was shot on Lake Michigan, and on the last day of filming this summer, we caught up with one of the people helping make that possible. Commander John Pruitt III is director of the U.S. Coast Guard's Motion Picture and Television Office, and he was on the set to make sure the movie's Coast Guard scenes went off without a hitch. Speaking from McKinley Marina, Commander Pruitt explained exactly what his job entails.
I work as the Coast Guard's liaison for motion pictures, television shows, and essentially documentaries.
Well, and so let me ask you this. How does the Coast Guard decide who it's going to work with and you know, when a project is appropriate for it to be involved?
What happens is projects approach us, and we work with the directors and producers to find out if their usage of the Coast Guard is actually appropriate in terms of, you know, it meets our service needs and service obligations, and it doesn't paint Coast Guard people in a negative light. And so if we can make their project work, then we will hopefully choose to work with them.
Well, and so you review the script, you take a look, and you, do you actually at some point work with the producers or directors and say, hey, we think it'd be more authentic if you did it this way?
Absolutely. We actually will work and review the script, and exactly in this case, actually I worked with the producer slash writer and helped to recraft some scenes, and even as of the day before shooting, we were actually rewriting scenes.
Well, can you give me, I don't know, how much nuts and bolts you're allowed to go into or they want you to go into, but what are the kinds of things that you would have them tweak?
Sure. Some of the things would be, say, if you want to say your classic military speak, the military tends to speak a little bit different than the average civilian. And just in terms of communication, it's sometimes faster the way we do it than the average person does. And then also things like today we were shooting a helicopter shoot. And so for that shoot, we wanted to make it exactly what we do in the Coast Guard. So when he wrote the script, didn't exactly mirror exactly all the things that we would normally do, so we kind of translated those things and made some corrections to ensure that what was portrayed was correct.
At the same time, I gather the Coast Guard personnel who are helping in this movie, they're not acting.
No, they're not. They are performing their job like they normally would. So in this movie, there was a rescue swimmer, which was the person that jumped out of the helicopter to go rescue a injured person. He did his job exactly how he would be trained to do it normally. So what you see in the movie is exactly what we do in the service of the American public every day.
So there is kind of almost a promotional aspect to the Coast Guard actually being a part of this movie.
Well, what this movie does, it allows us to show the American public what their tax dollars are at work and doing. So the American public can see, hey, this is what the Coast Guard does. And oftentimes, most people don't see the actual rescues. What they see is the resultant, is the person coming home. So now the American public will actually get a chance to see this is how it's actually done.
Are there concerns about putting Coast Guard personnel at risk in the course of making a movie?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's oftentimes our jobs aren't safe. Having a person jump out of a helicopter in the rough water is not a safe job. But he's really trained to do this. He's been training for years to do this. And also, we have safety personnel on the ground to actually help negotiate the scenes and the discussions and actually the radio communications to ensure it's as safe as possible.
Do the producers of the movie have to pay the Coast Guard to have the Coast Guard take part in this?
No. We don't charge them to do this, but they do compensate at times for different costs and expenses that we may have. So for lodging that we may incur, things like that. So that way, essentially, the American public doesn't have to foot the bill. That's the goal.
And that was what I was getting at. So how's it going?
Going great. This is a great opportunity. So loving it. And Milwaukee's beautiful. My first time here.
I was just about to ask, and that, obviously I was watching some of what was going on. Was this a tricky environment to be in today, given the conditions?
Absolutely. It's been a little windy today, and not only the windy, but the sea state was a little high. So, but absolutely beautiful. And as far as the swimmer goes, this was actually a walk in the park.
Well, and so let me ask you this question: how does someone who is serving the country as a member of the Coast Guard end up in the film liaison office?
You know what? Sometimes they go looking for, I guess, someone with maybe a little bit of charisma. And I've worked public affairs in the past throughout the Coast Guard. I was at the White House, actually, in their social office for a few years. And I was offered the position, and here I am today.
You have a sense for how many films the Coast Guard is involved in every year?
It varies. Right now in our office, we have 3 people in our office. And this is probably our 5th major film for the year, and we'll actually be working on some other ones starting next month. But really kind of our bread and butter these days are we have several shows on the Weather Channel, Coast Guard Alaska, Coast Guard Florida, and also coming Coast Guard Pacific Northwest.
All right. Well, thanks so much. Best of luck to you.
Indeed. Thank you very much. Thanks for having us out here in Milwaukee.
John Pruitt III is the director of the U.S. Coast Guard's Motion Picture and Television Office, based in Los Angeles. He was in Milwaukee in August on the set of the film The Surface, which is currently in production. Filmmaker Jeff Gendelman will talk about the movie in progress as part of a panel discussion Sunday afternoon at the Milwaukee Film Festival. One last break, and then we'll travel a long way from Milwaukee to Iceland via Australia with the author of a stunning new novel. This is Lake Effect on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich. A Wisconsin winter is often dark and some might say bleak, but it is nothing compared to what you would find in Iceland. And the Iceland of 1829 was an especially dark one for one woman in particular. In that year, Agnes Magnusdottir was convicted for her part in the murder of two men and sentenced to death. But before her execution, she was sent to live out her days with a family on a remote farm in northern Iceland. Australian writer Hannah Kent envisions what that time was like and how it affected both Agnes and the people who interacted with her in an affecting novel called Burial Rites. Kent was in Milwaukee recently and spent some time with us in the studio. It's a pleasure to meet you. Thanks for being with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
What captivated you first about Iceland and then about Agnes Magnusdottir's story, or was it the other way around?
It's a good question. I actually lived in Iceland 10 years ago when I was 17 years old. I'd finished high school in South Australia, where I grew up, and I was keen to go for a bit of an adventure before I settled down to further studies. So I applied for an exchange program, and basically, to cut a very long story short, I was the only applicant for this program who seemed remotely enthusiastic about going someplace where it was dark 20 hours a day in winter. And so I ended up spending a year in this very small, very isolated northern farmhouse. Oh, not farmhouse, rather, but farming slash fishing town on a northern fjord. And it was probably a few months after I first arrived at this place. I arrived in January, so it was very dark and very cold. And I was driven through this extraordinary tract of landscape in the north of the country, where the land, which is very pastoral, you have these gorgeous old sweeping glacial valleys and these mountain ranges, the land seems to erupt into hundreds of small hills. And as we passed through this area, my host family at the time told me that it had been the site for Iceland's last execution. And I was immediately intrigued, as I think anyone probably would be. And I asked them who it was and what had happened. And they told me that in 1830, a woman called Agnes Magnusdottir had been beheaded by broadaxe for her role in the very grisly murder of two men as they lay sleeping. And that was really the first time I heard the story. But from that point onwards, I harbored a very deep curiosity and fascination with this character, which, you know, fast forward 10 years, here we are, and I've written a book about her.
Well, and this is not necessarily the kind of detail that the local tourist information center would necessarily offer up first when somebody's arriving in a place. What did you see as the attitude towards the people who lived there about this story so many years later?
I think that's what interested me. The people seemed to be, most people in the area were very familiar with this story. In other places in Iceland, less so. But I was always really struck quite early on at the way in which they would talk about this woman, Agnes, almost as though she were this, a kind of Nordic Lady Macbeth, you know, this inherently wicked woman who had plotted out this very vicious crime. And something about that always, it never really sat easily with me. I was always very interested in her early life, you know, what other social, political, cultural forces might have pushed her to be in this very sorrowful position. And that was really the start of my research, which then led to writing a book. But people are familiar with the story, but I think they've accepted it as this very sort of a tragic myth almost.
Well, and was that where you initially found the tension from the beginning of where your story picks up? We know Agnes is doomed, mm-hmm. So what unfolds is not about what might happen to her.
No, and that was always very clear to me from the start. I think probably because the focus of the novel at this early stage when I decided I would write about her wasn't, you know, did she or didn't she do it? It was much more, I wanted to represent her as being ambiguous, I suppose, in direct, I guess, confrontation with those previous sources. So it's it was more about, I guess, her humanity in the last months of her life rather than anything else.
You had spent this year in Iceland, but you hadn't traveled to 1820s Iceland. How were you able to put yourself in that place?
Oh, look, it took a lot of research. I think had I known how much research. I would never have written the book, but by the time I realized I was too far into it, there was no turning back. Basically, I did this book as I wrote it as part of a PhD, which was wonderful because it meant I was on scholarship and I could write full time. So I spent about 2 years of full time research looking, at everything from very dry academic articles on smallpox epidemics to Icelandic fiction in translation to recipes on how to turn moss into porridge and ways that you could treat coughs with cabbage leaves. I mean, everything. If it was about early 19th century Iceland, I read it. And then I also, towards the end of my research, was able to go to Iceland and spend 6 weeks very intensively researching Agnes Magnusdottir's life in the archives there, which was wonderful. It was such a fantastic opportunity to have.
At the same time, this is a novel. It is historical fiction, but it is fiction. Were you concerned about over-romanticizing Agnes, making her out to be more sympathetic than she may have actually been?
I was very concerned about that. Right from the very start, I made sure that I was clear in my intentions to portray her, I guess, to encourage a response of empathy rather than sympathy. And I've done that, I hope, by exploring that ambiguity that I felt she must have surely had. You know, she was a very complex woman, and all the research that I, you know, managed to do supported this idea of her as being someone who was not entirely good, just as she was not entirely bad. So I hope it's up to the reader. And I've had quite a few readers respond in very different ways to the way in which I've portrayed certain events and her role in them. Some of people seem more inclined to sympathize with her, but others, I think, appreciate that she may also be quite unreliable.
There were two people that were killed in the crime that led to Agnes's execution, but the one we learn most about is Natan. But saying we learn about him, in quotation marks, might be misleading. He is also a pretty contradictory character. How difficult was it for you to get an accurate read on who he really was?
Natan Kettleson is a very interesting, or certainly character, but the character based on a very interesting man. And I think that was one of the reasons why very early on I seemed to consider, I felt that Agnes had been, it was unfair that she was always portrayed in unequivocal stereotypes, whereas he was allowed that ambiguity and that complexity. And so really, when it came to writing his character, I mean, I just tried to include everything I knew. He was this very gifted herbalist, you know, a doctor in a time where there weren't any hospitals or doctors, really. Yet at the same time, he'd been whipped for thievery when he was very young. He was a womanizer. Yet at the same time, he's very famous to this day for writing beautiful love poetry. So I really just decided to include all of that information and just hopefully the reader will accept him, you know, as he is. But that it was certainly the fact that he is so complex and so interesting that made me reconsider the way in which Agnes had been portrayed. Why wasn't she also interesting?
You know? He almost seemed like a celebrity as much as you could have a celebrity in 1820s remote northern Iceland.
Absolutely. And I think I've read a lot of local histories from the area, and it seems to me now as well that he certainly tried to cultivate that that interest in himself.
Certainly a cult of personality in ways.
Absolutely.
Well, and in a lot of ways, it seems that the truth really helped you. As a reader, I don't know that this would be nearly as compelling if Agnes hadn't been sent to live out her days on this, you know, remote farm and rather had been, you know, kept in jail until her beheading.
I know. I was very lucky because when I committed myself to this project, I thought that she may well be in jail for the whole time. I did know that she had a priest. I knew that from quite early on. So the novel could very well have been her communications with the priest or the reverend while she was imprisoned. But then, of course, I found out that no, there were no prisons in the north of Iceland. So she was sent to this poor family who basically had to take her on. And, of course, you do rub your hands together a little bit as a novelist because it introduces such wonderful narrative possibilities. But also then being able to go and research this family and to think what it would have been like for them and how their attitudes might have changed and shifted during the time during which Agnes was staying with them. That was fascinating. And I think, yes, probably without that, the book would be not quite so so interesting.
Can you pinpoint in yourself what it was when you were 17 that attracted you to this dark and somewhat mysterious place with a complicated language that was 10,000 miles from where you lived?
You know, I wish there was some very deep reason or, you know, I had considered it at great length before I went. The truth is the particular kind of exchange program I went in for, you asked to nominate three countries that you'd like to be considered for. But they choose the final destination after they've spoken with you and after you've completed the application process. And I had put down, I think, Iceland, Sweden, and Switzerland. And the reason I nominated those three countries was simply because I had never seen snow before. You know, I was raised in a very dry area of South Australia, and snow seemed to me to be an absolutely magical thing, and I had to set my eyes on it. So I thought I'd be in with a pretty good shot if I was sent to one of those countries. And then during the last round of interviews, I was seated in front of these three Rotarians, the men who would decide where I was going. And they were asking me all sorts of questions, you know, like, how will you deal with the homesickness and so on. And then one of them turned to me and said, Hannah, how would you respond if you were sent somewhere where it was dark 20 hours a day? And as I said before, I was very, very enthusiastic. And I remember them sort of raising their eyebrows and making a big cross next to my name. So that's how I ended up going there. But I actually knew very little about the country. And I also expected that if I was going to be sent there, I would be sent to Reykjavik, the capital in the south. And then I received a letter in the mail saying, congratulations, you're going to Iceland, to a place called Sauðárkrókur. And I sort of looked at my parents as I was living with them at the time, and they hadn't heard of it. We got out the family atlas, couldn't find it in the atlas, so I had no idea where I was and what to expect. But yes, in a way, I'm very glad.
I wonder if you felt that your own kind of isolation as an exchange student might have given you some insight into the way Agnes would have felt as she was sent to live on this remote farm.
I've thought about this a lot recently because I do remember being immediately interested with Agnes's story in a way that was probably quite unusual. And I do think there's a lot to – I think my interest really did lie in the fact that I was having a very hard time of it when I first heard this story. I mean, I knew that it would be – the weather would be different. I knew the landscape would be different. I knew I'd probably be homesick. And I was – and all of those things did have an impact on me. But I don't think I had anticipated the difficulties of entering a small, quite tightly knit community as an outsider, as the Australian exchange student. And I really, really struggled, you know, on top of the bad weather, on top of the way the darkness compounded everything, on top of homesickness, I really struggled with the fact that I was incredibly conspicuous. I mean, everyone in the town seemed to know who I was and what I'd had for breakfast. But at the same time, I was completely socially isolated because very few people would come up and talk to me. So I felt very self-conscious. I was aware that people were in the same room looking over, speaking in Icelandic about me. I had no idea what they were saying. And I really, really struggled. And I think at the time that I heard the story, just the very few basic facts of Agnes's life, there was something in her own story of being conspicuous, that's yet socially isolated, and being alienated, and probably being very lonely in exactly the same place that I was then, that would have resonated with me. And I think that's probably the heart of why I never really forgot her story.
Do you feel like you owed something to Agnes, that you had a responsibility to tell this story in a certain way?
Yes, I think every historical novelist has certain responsibilities. I was very towards the past to ensuring that they get their facts right. I was very aware of my own status, even in the years afterwards. Even after I'd embraced Iceland and learnt the language and had a wonderful time there, I was still very aware of the fact that I was an Australian writing about a country that's not my own, about a time that I was utterly familiar with. And I felt an obligation to Agnes to ensure that I didn't go too far in the other direction. You know, I didn't want to portray her as a monster and support this common representation of her as this sort of stereotype again. But I didn't want to go too far in the other direction and make her so sympathetic that it was just as bad, you know, two sides of the same coin, basically. So I did feel that I owed it to her to do my research, to make sure I got my facts right, to understand the world that she was living in and that particular society, and then, I guess, work from there. So whenever I encountered a fact or whenever I knew something, that was unaffected by bias or wasn't contradicted by another source, I made myself stick to it in the book. So everything that is imagination in this book is also suggested by that broader research into Iceland. That was very important to me, actually. I didn't want to annoy any Icelanders.
Do you feel like you have a greater insight at this point, maybe after this process, into what would make someone go so far as to do the things or be a part of the things that Agnes did or was a part of?
I do. And in some ways, I'm not surprised by what I learned. I mean, I always had this very strong intuitive feeling that Agnes was involved in this crime. And there's no doubt that she was involved. And even if she were tried to this day, she'd still be found guilty of something. I always knew that, but I always had this very strong sense that it wasn't because of inherent monstrosity, that she wasn't someone who was inclined to bad behaviour for its own sake or to criminality for its own sake. I never thought of her as a deviant, and I guess that's what I wanted to explore and what I wanted to prove myself correct in. And I did find that. And I mean, we are all creatures of the times that we live in. We are all shaped by the sort of expected roles that are there for us, regardless, you know, regarding our gender or our class. And Agnes's life, in many ways, her tragic fate was not necessarily caused by it, but there were certain factors that contributed to her being in this very sad situation. And they included things that I discovered, such as illegitimacy, a lack of a family or kinship network, you know, the fact that she was a woman, the fact that she was probably ambitious, and that would have been a quality of her own, but in a time where that ambition was not able to be fulfilled, which would have probably led to frustration and so on. So a lot of factors, and it, you start to see someone as, you know, as less of a cartoon character jumping around, and much more someone who led a very deep and in many ways conflicted life.
What do you know about why Agnes's execution was the last in Iceland's history?
People have asked me whether the execution directly led to the abolishment of capital punishment, and I'm always reluctant to say that it did, because capital punishment wasn't abolished in Iceland until, I think, 1928, and you know, almost 100 years after Agnes was killed. But I think it was such a huge event at that time because crime, even to this day, is still very rare in Iceland, and particularly back then. I mean, even now, I think there's only a population of 320,000. So when horrible events like this occur, they reverberate throughout the community. And the execution as well wasn't a cause for celebration or joy. It was very much something that people were repelled by, and I think disgusted. As much as they might have been repelled and disgusted by Agnes, I don't think they were necessarily supportive of her death either.
Hannah Kent, thank you so much for spending some time with us.
Oh, thank you very much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Australian writer Hannah Kent's novel is called Burial Rites, published by Little Brown and Company. Kent is also co-founder and director of an Australian literary magazine called Kill Your Darlings. She was in Milwaukee last week for a reading at Boswell Book Company. That's the Friday edition of Lake Effect. We're produced by Dan Harmon, Bonnie North, and Stephanie Lecce, with incredible support from Nathan Royster and Eleanor Peterson. John Strelecki is our studio engineer. I'm Mitch Dyke. Looks like it might be a damp weekend, perfect for spending some time with your radio. Lake Effect Weekend airs Saturday and Sunday afternoon at 3, right here on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh air is next. It's 11 o'clock.